Hello, and welcome to a very special episode of the Reason Roundtable. This is the podcast of free minds, free markets, and free takes. And we're coming to you from Austin, Texas, on the very final night of another great Reason weekend. We have a live audience tonight. So this is a very special episode. I am your host, Peter Suderman. And tonight I am joined by my illustrious colleagues, Matt Welch, Catherine Mangu-Ward, and Nick Gillespie. Everyone say hello.
Howdy.
Hello.
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 Hey, Reason Roundtable listeners. Peter Suderman here. Do you know a student looking for a transformative opportunity that supports the foundations of a free society? Reliance College invites students age 16 to 24 to the 2025 Great Connection Seminar in Chicago from July 26th to August 2nd. This year's theme, Reason and Free Will, dives into timeless ideas from writers such as Thomas Jefferson, Ayn Rand, and Aristotle. Students can sharpen critical thinking skills in small dynamic groups, developing the intellectual tools needed to thrive in a free society. Outside the classroom, they will explore Chicago's vibrant culture, touring museums, trying improv comedy, and building lifelong personal connections. Parents, this program equips students to think, reason, and act independently. Go to reliancecollege.org/reason to learn more and apply. Registration is just $800, including room and board for the full week with scholarships available. Don't miss out. Visit reliancecollege.org/reason to learn more and apply. That's reliancecollege.org/reason to learn more and apply. Happy Saturday to everyone who loves that everything is bigger in Texas. And that includes this podcast. So normally we have four libertarians on our podcast to discuss the news, but tonight we are joined by what I am told is 156 libertarians and friends of freedom. Which, if I understand the deep principles and philosophy of libertarianism, means that we have, at the bare minimum, 157 opinions about just about everything in here tonight. So usually I start the podcast by going around the panel and asking them a question. And the question is usually, what do you think? But I get to talk to these folks every single week. So tonight, I am going to ask you all what you think. And in particular, I'm going to ask you what you think about a bunch of aspects of Donald Trump's second term, Trump 2.0 here. So let's just start. And I want you, as I say things, I want you to express your opinion. Make it known, cheer or boo or jeer, or give me something that the microphones can hear that will help us understand what it is that you think. So number one, DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency.
All right, good thing.
Trump's tariffs on autos, on Canada, on Mexico. Okay. Trump's tax cuts. Extending the TCJA? Maybe? No? No taxes on tips and Social Security, and I think generators? Maybe? All right. Okay. So Trump's immigration and border policy. All right, I hear claps, I hear boos. There's a wide array of opinions here. Trump's executive orders on DEI and free speech. DEI and free speech, okay, great. Okay, so it sounds like we have a wide range of views here, and we're gonna try to wrestle with those views and represent those views tonight. And I wanna start with DOGE, because to me, Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency is the signature thing about the Trump second term for libertarians here. The stated goals of DOGE are to cut trillions of dollars in spending and streamline government operations. We have not seen big budget reductions yet, but we have seen real efforts to dramatically reduce the federal workforce. People affiliated with DOGE say they are hard at work upgrading outdated government systems, and that would not be happening in another administration, certainly the other one that was up for election last year. So I kind of think we, just to start here, need to stop and like appreciate and celebrate that. And maybe do a little dance. So a couple of weeks ago on the pod, Catherine suggested that what we really needed more of was DOGE dance parties. And that is what we are going to have. In fact, I asked ChatGPT to give me a picture of what a DOGE dance party would look like. And this is what it would look like. It would look like a whole bunch of Shiba Inus dancing in their dance clothes. And
no underwear. Notice on the ones on the right there.
No underwear.
shirt
I didn't
cocking
catch that,
all the way down.
But thank you, Matt, for zeroing in on this, right? So for my first question, what we're going to do is we're just going to go around the panel and want each of you to tell me one thing that you really like about Doge. And then, in conjunction with that, we're going to do a little dance, and I am going to start. Because what I like about Doge is that it is shaking up Washington. Washington is, of course, where I live. And when I go to the gym or to my dog park or just walk around my neighborhood, I hear people talking about Doge. And the way they're talking about it is interesting. This is a true story. I had a neighbor who I don't know very well, but I think works in some sort of government jobs, probably doing some sort of IT contracting, something like that, right? And he came up to me on the street the other day and he just had this like haggard look. And he was like, man, are you okay? Are you okay? And I was like, yeah, I'm okay. I don't think he knows what it is that I do. But the point is, Doge is shaking up Washington, and it is causing people who work for the government, who are paid with taxpayer dollars, to do something. And this is where the dancing comes in. That's right. It's causing people to freak out, and I think in a mostly good way. That is not an end unto itself. You can take it too far. Freaking out doesn't get us all the way, but it is something that needed to happen. Someone needed to come to Washington and say, let's not keep doing things this way anymore. So Catherine, I'm gonna start with you. You came up with the idea for this dance party. And I know you just wanna have fun. Also, you're a lady. So I have a song for you that we're gonna play right now.
It's my Doge dance party. That's it. I'm done.
Right.
That was enough, right? Okay.
That's
I can tell you
party.
The thing that
That's
I like.
That's your dance party.
That was my Doge dance party. I am very sorry to everyone in this room. This was my idea. I take full responsibility. And I'm delighted to see what is about to happen with the Nick and Matt phases of the Doge dance party. But my favorite thing about Doge is Steve Davis. I don't know if anybody read the incredibly sinisterly framed profile of Elon Musk's top lieutenant in the papers the other day. He came from SpaceX, from the Boring Company with Musk, and he is a friend of mine, a person that I know. The main way that I know him is that he sometimes comes to my house and we play board games. It's been a while because he's been busy. And at these board game nights, he drinks chocolate milk. And I feel that a person in charge of cutting government in America who likes board games and chocolate milk and rockets can't be bad. It just can't. So Steve Davis is my favorite part of Doge. At this point, I think all we can really do is trust in the people because the results are murky. I recognize that that is me saying we need to trust Elon Musk.
Right, or the government.
But, you know, Steve Davis, pretty good.
All right, Matt, you're up next. So I said up front that we needed a celebration of Doge, and you are a pretty cool guy. So what are you going to get for your dance party?
Don't take off your pants. I see you looking at that picture. Don't.
It's aspirational. Everyone wants to porky pig a little bit in their lives. Who doesn't? I think Ben Franklin's quote was, it's a republic if you can keep from having stupid dance parties at a freezing
weekend. I do remember that.
Weekend. I have criticisms of Doge, which we might get into. We had hope at the beginning when Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal that was actually pretty interesting and measured, talking about all of the ways they're going to do some rescissions of regulatory state overreach and stuff. It was like a CEI document. It's like, oh, whoa, that sounds more serious than what I had thought. And then now Elon Musk like wakes up every morning and just like rips some ketamine and starts talking about, they just did a $1 trillion survey about something. Can you believe it? I'm like, okay, so we're not doing the serious one. But in the process of doing all of the things that they have done, they occasionally just end USAID. It's like this margin call of like, all right, let's stop that thing. And some of those things, and I'm sure it's all going to be haphazard and kind of capricious, but some of those things, as per David's opening night remarks, birthday boy David, who knows where he is, are going to turn out that people are going to look around and go, yeah, we didn't really need to do that. And it was just sort of this bureaucracy that grew forever. And we thought that's the way that we should do it. And we no longer have to do it that way. Those things are the things that I'm looking forward to. And if I was ever going to dance in a chair, I might think about doing that at some point.
All right, Nick, speaking of chair dancing, you give us life every night, this night in particular. So you are going to get... How is Doge keeping you dancing and saying
alive? I hope it's not keeping anything alive in the government. And one of the things that I do like about Doge is that it just is calling attention to stupid government funding of stuff. And I like the endless list of bad NIH studies that we've funded over the years, including a 2017 one that spent over $700,000 to study whether couples in counties where the Super Bowl took place, do they have a baby boom 9 months later? And it turned out that they don't, which is not really interesting. But that procession of, you know, these are things Reason and other libertarian organizations have spent years, if not decades, kind of listing stupid, wasteful government spending. In this context, every little kind of chip at the tree makes it more likely to fall over. So I like that.
That's good. Okay, so it's not all dancing. It's not all celebration here. It's not all cool in the gang. There are, I think, some concerns about Doge here. And I actually just want to ask all of you, what are your concerns about Doge? Do you have any issues here? Anything you want to raise? Nick, let's start with you.
Yeah, it's mostly bullshit, right? It started a conversation, but it's not a serious conversation. Matt briefly mentioned Musk talking about $1 billion or, well, yeah, $1 billion study of that the National Park survey that the National Parks had done. It's just wrong. And like on almost every...
It is an $835 million contract with an organization that does survey research that included a question about whether you like parks.
Right.
It's not $1 billion
park survey.
It's
the Department of Interior, et cetera. When you look, people like Jessica Riedel, the Manhattan Institute economist, has said the actual savings are somewhere around $2 billion. Doge itself is claiming $55 billion. You know, we're looking at a rounding error, and that bothers me because this is the opportunity to really get serious about cutting government and about cutting government spending and cutting entitlements and things like that. And I hope that we don't waste it on small ball type stuff.
Catherine, concerns?
Yeah, this is actually just the same concern that I've had about my work at Reason, about our work at Reason, which is, it's very hard to decide when you should lose your mind about the little stuff that makes people really upset and when you should focus on the big stuff that really matters. And for years, I was like, no, we should only write 8,000 word articles about how to privatize Social Security because nothing else matters. That's the only thing that matters. But as Matt—
8,000 words.
Not
I
you,
heard
Peter.
That.
Not you.
That's a long article.
You don't get 8,000 words. But as Matt, I think, recalls when he was my boss and I was a wee junior writer, I came around and I used to just write a post at 4:20 every day about like food or drugs, because actually that's what people want to get mad about. They want to get mad about limits on the sizes of sodas, and they want to get mad about, you know, not being able to just like smoke weed. And I think this is Doge. This is like people want little things to get mad about, and I want them to have those. But I worry that we never get to the 8,000 words on Social Security.
Matt, concerns?
So did we decide they ended the Department of Education or not? It was a coin toss. Are we?
We don't know
that now. So they've fired a bunch of people from the Department of Education, which is something that we've been talking about since before the Department of Education was birthed upon us at Reason. And so that's exciting. And then the continuing resolution that they signed into law 10 days ago or whatever, funded the Department of Education at the exact same level as it was last year and the year before that. And so you, what happens when you engage in sort of deliberately confrontational or politically pugilistic kind of shock actions that at the same time don't do a ton? I'm happy to have half the people at the Department of Education not have a job tomorrow. That sounds pretty cool to me. But if you're not also cutting government in any meaningful way, and the deficit this year is $1.8 trillion this year signed into law. That's what we got. And there's no prospect for that going down at all in a meaningful way. So what happens when this is just done by the executive branch, whoever runs it right now? They do these things with their pen and their phone. It says to me that in the long term, this might be somebody else who gets the pen and the phone, and we just lurch back and forth between executive actions. Meanwhile, the fundamental lines of the thing that we care about, which is the size and the spending of government, is untroubled by any of that. So that, to me, it seems to be a squandered opportunity. So that's my biggest worry about it.
Okay, so let's talk about a different topic. We're going to move on to tariffs and taxes here. In some ways, because they're kind of the same thing, right? Tariffs are a tax on American people. And so on the one
hand,
Trump
what I
is
heard.
Calling.
I heard tariffs are definitely not taxes, Peter.
Oh.
That's what the president keeps saying.
I'm sorry. I've just gotten it completely wrong. Thank you for correcting me, Catherine. On Wednesday, Trump announced a new set of 25% tariffs that are definitely not taxes that will apply to imported cars. And the White House's own projections say that this will basically generate $100 billion in revenue, but that's $100 billion in taxes on Americans. At the same time, Trump ran on tax cuts. He has promised no taxes on tips, like I said, no taxes on Social Security, maybe no taxes on generators. I'm not sure I really understand that one, as well as the extension of the individual tax cuts in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that was passed under Trump's first term, except maybe not. There was a report just this week while we were at Reason Weekend that maybe Trump is considering allowing taxes to rise, at least on high earners under the TCJA, for political reasons and also to pay for some of the other stuff or create fiscal space for the other stuff. So how do we feel about this very strange, internally contradictory, difficult to pin down because we don't know what all of the tariffs are going to be here? But how do we feel about the kind of the tariffs and taxes part of the Trump administration, Nick?
Not good.
Yeah.
Thanks.
That's right.
Yeah. And the tariffs are bad. And you know, you're getting more Trump administration officials who are saying, hey, you know what? Tariffs aren't a tax. They're good for the economy. They're going to make the economy better. But we should also prepare for a one-time adjustment or a short but deep recession and things like that. So, I mean, the game is out. And you know, tariffs are bad, and I don't think really we need to argue that too much. But then the tax cuts, like I want to pay fewer taxes, but I also want the government to spend less. And like if you're not doing those things in concert, you're just passing the buck the way that, you know, it's been getting kicked down the road forever.
So Catherine, the Trump administration and supporters say that the tariffs taxes thing, like those go together for a reason. Because we're going to pay for the government with tariffs rather than taxes.
Yeah, I'm going to put on my powdered wig and I'm going to get my fife and drum out and we're just going to go back to the good old days. I mean,
I want a fife and drum dance party.
I do too. That would be awesome. I love a marching band, as you know. I think, you know, this is like, if in fact that thing happened where we so dramatically shrank the size of government that we could in fact fund it with a few moderate tariffs, like, sure, sign me up, love it. But until we get to that day, I do think my favorite part of what is going down right now with tariffs and taxes is it is a delight to hear the American left lip sync our arguments about why tariffs are bad, right? Like, that's been fun. Just to hear lefties be like, actually, global trade can be a force for good. And, you know, tariffs are actually taxes on Americans. I'm like, say it again. Say it again. Say it when a Democrat is president.
Matt, tariffs and taxes.
100% tariffs on every bit of good that comes from abroad. And assuming that Americans decide to pay that import tax, gets you, I think, and I could get the numbers wrong, and I'm sure there are people who used to work for the Federal Reserve who will come and hunt me down afterwards. But I think that gets you around $2.3 trillion. So good luck with your $7 trillion budget.
It's a real tiny
your
government.
100% tariffs would get you that. So Trump has this idea. There's a reason why he name-checked William McKinley over and over again, including on Inauguration Day, including renaming Mount McKinley Mount McKinley on day one, is that he wanted, he looks back at that era of high tariffs, no tax, as being kind of a golden era, and why can't we do that in reverse? And there are at least a few advisors around him who agree with that and think that's a good idea. And then there's plenty of people in the Republican Party who will say anything that Donald Trump wants them to say and agree with it. And then that combination is he's trying to get there. And the biggest problem with that is not even, in my estimation, the actual kind of intellectual argument against tariffs. It's a procedural or practical argument about what the president can and cannot do right now. The president can go, boop, tariff. National security, I don't know, fentanyl, and it happens. He cannot do that with taxes. So he can't just snap his fingers and get rid of taxes, even on tips, which is now a bipartisan idea. It's complicated. He has this much of a margin in Congress. So what's he going to do? He's going to do this with tariffs, and he's going to do a lot of jawboning on taxes that's going to lead to some kind of kludgy mess. So he's not going to get that perfect swap, the McKinley-esque swap. So just stuff is going to be more expensive and the government's going to take more of your money.
Speaking of things that are going to be more expensive, I will take the last word because that is the name of one of my very favorite cocktails. And that cocktail relies a lot on a number of European ingredients that you can't, there's not an American version. You can't substitute something that's made here. This is not something that Americans can just do. And a friend of mine, a friend of reason, Jordan McGillis, who works for the Manhattan Institute, recently did some calculations and found that a last word made at home, this is not at a bar, under Trump's tariffs will cost $12 to $13. Why not just go get it at a bar at that point, except at the bar it's going to cost an awful lot more. Trump's tariffs are bad for many reasons.
What's the ingredient here? What are you saying Americans can't do?
Yeah.
Chartreuse.
All right.
And Luxardo maraschino liqueur. Okay, let's move on to another issue that involves borders, immigration, and border policy. When Trump was running, he promised mass deportations, crackdown on immigration. And we haven't seen mass deportations yet. We have seen some very concerning deportations and people being detained for long periods of time, in some cases, for unclear reasons. Nick, tell us how you feel about this.
I don't feel good about
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Not feeling very good about a lot of things here.
No, but, you know, the one thing, and Trump should get credit for securing the border. Biden had actually last June had pushed through a bunch of stuff that had massively reduced people coming across the border. It is good to have a secure border, you know, to the south and to the north. That's not where a majority of illegal people are coming in. We need immigrants and we need reform on the legal side of immigration, which has gone missing for 40 years now. But, you know, if you are going to start rounding people up and you don't check their identification that they're carrying with them for hours or days, something has gone horribly wrong. And I don't think anybody really wants to live in that country.
Yeah. So Catherine, Nick raises the issue of due process, and it seems like people are not getting it. And in fact, at a town hall just this week, there was a Republican from Indiana, Victoria Spartz, who said, if you violated the law, you are not entitled to due process.
Just facts.
I don't think that's how due process works. Is this?
It is not. And, you know, there's always going to be idiots, right?
Congress, yes.
In Congress sometimes. But I do think, you know, the fact that, you know, the fact that that is kind of where the conversation is resting is not ideal. Of course, the other version of this that we've seen is people who are here on various types of visas on campuses. And I think that this is understandably something where it does come down to the nitty gritty in some of these cases. It does come down to the specific facts. And, you know, the thing that comes to mind is that the reason we have due process is not for people who are unambiguous cases and not for people who are sympathetic. We have it for people who maybe suck and did something non-ideal, who are still, you know, they should still be accorded due process. And I think that that is, you know, we've seen some test cases. I think we're going to see a lot more. And things that do not disqualify you from due process are writing an op-ed about Israel. Things that do not disqualify you from having due process are having tattoos. Things that do not disqualify you from due process are, you know, they are myriad, and we are going to see a lot of those tested, unfortunately.
Matt, how concerned should we be about this? I mean, when we talk about this on the podcast, one response we get is, well, look, maybe it's a problem, but this is the sort of problem, you know, maybe it's even unconstitutional, but Biden did unconstitutional stuff. It was bad, but we don't freak out about this. We go through the courts and it sort of works itself out. Don't panic, right? How do you respond to that?
Well, I agree with not panicking. I also agree with at any given time, certainly mine and probably most people in the world in this room's preferences.
Those are importantly different subsets.
Yes, thank you. You know, are going to be in an extreme minority position on the way the public policy is executed and how you approach that, whether you freak out about it or whether you cheerfully go into the breach, is kind of up to you. An aspect about two of the aspects that I find most troubling about Trump this time, and similar to last time too, but the due process that Catherine was just talking about is troubling. For those of us who believe in strong, and I'm not really saying us, but those in this room who believe in really strong immigration enforcement, anytime you do anything that is pretty significant in cracking down on illegal immigration, almost certainly you're going to get legal residents ensnared in that. So just think of your, I forget the name of it, the E-Verify, right? So like if you're, every employer has to prove to the government that all of its workers are legal citizens. Who gets caught? Women who've changed their names. That's who gets caught, who are American citizens more often than not. So that happens. There are due process issues. But for me, there are probably, I don't know how many in this room, but I know I've talked to some people who are in this room because America used to be the place that took on refugees. We took on refugees from Vietnam, from Cuba, from Cambodia, from Russia, Jews from Russia as well. We were understood under both Carter and Reagan, especially to take kind of a lead role in the world of processing refugees, particularly from authoritarian countries. The refugee and the immigration crisis that we've had over the last 5-10 years, and I think it has been a crisis, has been largely from Venezuela, authoritarian country, basically commie at this point, spitting people out. It's a difficult question, and it always is more difficult than I think a lot of people want to acknowledge, regardless of where they are on the position. But what Trump did in his first term was historical in snapping that refugee door shut. There are many problems with the system, tons, backlogs of being able to process the applicants, you know, people going through this little loophole over here, plenty of problems with that. But he took down a refugee intake to less than 20,000 a year from the entire world at a time when the worldwide global population of refugees basically doubled from 10 million people to 20 million people. We're doing that again right now. So I like my vision of America is a place that uniquely compared to almost every other country, especially in Western Europe, takes in, assimilates, processes, champions refugees who are fleeing authoritarian hellholes. We are now not doing that anymore. That is no longer the character of America. I am not panicked about that, but I'm embarrassed by it.
Yeah, and it's also, we should point out places, you know, there are cases where people who were critics of the Maduro regime in Venezuela are here pending legal processing and get sent to El Salvadoran prison en route back to Venezuela. That's not a good America. I mean, and we should be clear about that. America should be always a place where people who want freedom and are escaping tyranny can come here and kind of become something different. And that's not a small thing. And it really, it's the ugliest, I think it's the ugliest aspect of Trump 2.0. And it's worth always pushing back against.
Yeah, so, great. So we'll move on to DEI and free speech. One of Trump's first executive orders on January 20th was an executive order restoring freedom of speech and against federal censorship. Catherine, is Donald Trump good for free speech?
I mean, I think Donald Trump is good for the culture of free speech in the sense that, for sure, like, you cannot deny that the DEI, you know, the DEI order, and also just in general, his, you know, he does say the right words about free speech at the highest level, and would-be restrictors have heard that, and people who were kind of looking for cover, looking for their right moment to stop doing some of these practices, have taken that opportunity. His effect on that side of the culture of free speech is good. He also will definitely be using the government to silence people, for sure. He did it during his first term. This, like, ongoing kerfuffle with CBS is just, like, one little piece. The thing I mentioned earlier about folks who are losing their visas and status in the country over, as far as I can tell, at least in one case, just words published in the press. That is not, in fact, protecting free speech.
Yeah, or that they pissed off Marco Rubio. Right. He seems to have a long enemies list of people whose visas he wants to
pull. I hope someday to be on Marco Rubio's enemies list. What do you think? I think that's an attainable goal.
I think it's short jokes. That's what it is.
I don't want to do it ad hominem. Yeah. I want to do it, you know, real.
This actually goes to the point that you were making earlier, Catherine, though, because at least some of the reporting has suggested that one of the people who was picked up off the streets in a sort of viral video where it shows, you know, hooded men who are not, you know, identified by, you know, they don't have badges on, they don't have uniforms, and you're just picking somebody off the streets. And there have been reports in, like, the New York Times saying this person was picked up because of an op-ed that she wrote. And then it turns out that there is at least an argument. I don't know if it is true. There's an argument being made that, well, she's actually being picked up because she committed some crimes like vandalism. And it's very difficult to tell, right? It's very difficult to know
here. There's this way that you tell in these situations.
Wait, what if there was some process?
Like a due process? Yeah.
You know, it is worth pointing out in the speech executive order, though, that the way that the Biden administration did kind of strong arm, jawbone pressure social media companies to, you know, de-amplify people, restrict people and things like that during COVID, it is definitely worth remembering that and making sure that kind of stuff doesn't happen again.
And I'm around the necks of Democrats like a fucking anchor, pardon my French, for a long time. That was one of the most egregious acts of government in the 21st century, of just censoring the way Rand Paul was kicked off YouTube. He's a senator. And he was kicked off YouTube for, like, questioning the efficacy of masks for 6 months. That was widespread. The White House press the secretary, whatever, was like, okay, we have a dirty dozen of people that we want Spotify to ban. This happened. There was, like, whole of government or whole of society, even, things done by government to crack down on COVID speech. It was unprecedented in modern American history, and it should not at all be forgotten. Right. And sorry, I just totally interrupted you.
That's what the podcast is
whole
for.
The whole premise of the Trump coalition was supposedly to strike this down, right? Like, we're going to be against where this culture of free speech is punishing the Democrats righteously. And I celebrated that the day after the election. That was you could feel the vibe shift in the culture. Justin Bateman could finally speak freely again. Great. I'm into that. And to then do your day one executive order and then get little Marco out and saying, I really don't like the way these op-eds have run for these 300. We're finding them out one by one.
And it's also things like going after law firms that defended or took positions that the Trump administration doesn't like, threatening things like that, going after CBS or NBC or whatever, because they might have edited an interview away that bothered Trump.
Saying they should take their licenses away. I mean, they have that power.
That's all before we get to the stuff on the internet where we have, you know, laws that are attempting to force social media companies to carry conservative opinions. And also the stuff where we're, you know, having age gating for all types of contents at the state level, mostly Republican states. It's a lot of stuff that's not great for speech.
To go along with what you were saying, I do think this might have the beneficial effect for free speech, because it is forcing people to be like, okay, we can't just keep going back. Like, when my side does it, it's good. We need to get to a clearing point or a synthesis rather than a thesis and antithesis that, no, we actually want free speech. We want limited government. We want something different than what we've been dealing with for at least the past 20 years. So in that way, I think Trump may end up being great for free speech, because it will force everybody to actually come to some common agreement about basic principles.
There was a lot of people who righteously rebelled against the woke excesses that could, like, crystallize the most in 2020, when everyone freaked out and started posting black squares on their Instagram and like defenestrating the head of the Poetry Foundation for reasons that are obscure to this day. So that was all insane, and all normies understood that to be insane, and they hated the way that HR was sort of like sitting on their pockets and telling them to recite the catechism and go read some Ibram X. Kendi. All of that makes a lot of sense to people. And so it excited a kind of centristy of like, hey, look, due process, free speech, we like those things. And to replace that with anti-woke, anti-free speech, anti-due process is insane. And I think the administration will see its popularity plummet pretty quickly.
And by the way, in keeping with that, I do want to report, I had a conversation at dinner where somebody kept talking about something called the Gulf of Mexico. I'm not sure who I should report that to.
If you say it on the podcast, they're going to come for him.
Okay. Yeah. But I mean, this is or like, her. I want to report a crime.
The Gulf of Mexico is currently in a holding facility in Louisiana. it's a bad scene. Right. So I will cap this conversation by pointing out an executive order that came out while we were at Reason Weekend. This is an executive order restoring truth and sanity to American history. Okay, so maybe,
so
right?
It's a whitewash.
Is there a lot of truth in sanity? There's a lot of truth. I'm not sure there's a lot of sanity. There's a lot of delightful insanity in American history. But this orders the Vice President, J.D. Vance, to work with the Smithsonian to, and this is a quote, to remove improper ideology from such properties. To remove improper ideology. And so this is why I grouped DEI and free speech together, because these are sort of the yin and the yang, right? The kind of Tweedledum and Tweedledee, the Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito of, like, Trump's, you know, way of approaching free speech, is that on the one hand, he positions himself as a free speech warrior, but he is also warring against free speech that he doesn't like. And both are true in many ways.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Therapy can feel like a big investment, but the state of your mind is just as important as your physical health. Let's talk numbers. Traditional in-person therapy can cost anywhere from $100 to $250 per session. That adds up fast. But with BetterHelp Online Therapy, you can save on average up to 50% per session. With BetterHelp, you pay a flat fee for weekly sessions, saving you big on cost and time. Therapy should feel accessible. It's not a luxury. With online therapy, you get quality care at a price that makes sense and can help you with anything from anxiety to everyday stress to just feeling worn out. Your mental health is worth it. And now it's within reach. Therapy is a helpful tool for learning positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. It empowers you to be the best version of yourself. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform. It's served over 5 million people globally. It's convenient, too. You can join a session with a click of a button, helping you fit therapy into your busy life. Plus, you can switch therapists at any time. Your well-being is worth it. Visit BetterHelp.com/roundtable today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/roundtable.
I want to move on here to something that everyone agrees on about Trump, which is that all the people who love him and all the people who hate him agree on, I think, one thing, which is he's funny. He's funny, and sometimes he's funny on purpose. Sometimes he's funny not on purpose. He's just sort of insane, and you have to laugh. And so, actually, I want all of you to just go through here. I want to go down the line, and we're going to start with Matt Welch. And I want you to share the funniest, most absurd, most strange, weird, insane thing about Trump's second term.
I will reject the premise a little bit in that there's still a group of people who will tell you in very mad, he's not funny. Why do you say that he's funny? Did you see what he does? He does all these terrible things. It's like, bro, he's funny. And if you stop understanding why your fellow Americans think he's funny, you're going to continue to lose everything all the time. The State of the Union address, again, I paid way too much attention to these things. There's a whole like 19-minute bit, I'm exaggerating only a little bit, where he's like, no, they got these the Social Security people, they're 161 years old, Marco. And he just like went on and on with all these exaggerated ages of people who are on the Social Security rolls. And it was hilarious and it was great and I loved it and it was totally inconsequential and it was mostly a lie. And that is perfect Donald Trump. It was like insult comedy in the room. He's got great timing. We know a lot of comics in New York spend some time around the Comedy Cellar, and they will all just tell you, it's insane the comedic timing the guy has. And to apply that in, like, a State of the Union address and just to have this sort of gag with a running tally, and then also to have it kind of meaningless at the end and in classic Trump form filled with BS is just, it's perfect. It says a lot about it.
Catherine, does anything about Donald Trump strike you as absurd?
Peter, I'm a lady. And so I want to talk about how Donald Trump is the fertilization president. I don't know if any of you guys caught that news this week.
Is this related to the Super Bowl?
We'll have to do a study to find out. So this is, he's just given a press conference. He's talking to people and, you know, he's talking about IVF, but he does the thing where he just mentally and verbally wanders off.
It's called the weave. He's talked about
that. Yeah. And it's so he's like, they call me the fertilization president. He's previously said, that he's also the father of IVF, which is like both just technically and sort of metaphorically troubling. And he's like, I don't mind it. Like, I am kind of the fertilization. I have no idea what's going on. It's not clear he has any idea what's going on. I guess I will find the silver lining and just say that, I am very pro-choice. I do not like how abortion policy is shaping up in this country under Trump. Obviously, the Supreme Court led the way with that. But I do appreciate that Trump himself retains some common sense impulses on reproductive rights. And one of them is like, at some point, you know, the kind of pro-life extreme Republicans got a little high on their own supply and they were like, yes, now we're going to ban IVF. And they got like really, and Trump just kind of said, what? No, people really like that. I'm the father of IVF. And I just think that attitude will in fact protect IVF and keep it legal at least for the next 4 years. So thanks, Daddy.
I loved when he said everything is computer, because we all knew exactly what he meant. And there's like, you know, we have had at least a series of presidents who pretty clearly have dementia. But when he said that, you know, you have to be like, yeah, you know what? This is like if you woke up from a long nap and you saw a Tesla or almost anything, you'd be like, holy cow, this is like science fiction. So he knows what he's talking about.
If you haven't watched the video, it's really incredible. It is at basically a used car sale that they hosted in front of the White House with Elon Musk and his new Tesla. Okay, they're not used, but his new Teslas. And Trump gets in and he's just like, oh, it's beautiful. Oh, it's so beautiful. He can't stop saying it. It was so beautiful. And he gets in the car and the first words that come, everything's computer. And it is this moment that you never see from Trump of genuinely like childlike wowed innocence.
But he's like the caveman lawyer that Phil Hartman played on Saturday Night Live, right? Where it's like, your ways are strange, but instead of being frightened, he's happy about it. But it is, and again, I mean, you know what he means and it's good, but it's also like, where have you been the past 25, 30 years? But
not driving his own cars, but it is.
Or even looking into...
This was actually the moment that stuck out to me, and I loved it because on the one hand, it's absurd, and it's such a classic Trump moment, but it's also a reminder that we live in a world of wonderful, magical computer abundance in which everything is computer. And that would be true whether or not Donald Trump was president. And it also
provides me a little bit of a segue to our next topic. We've talked a lot about Republicans and Donald Trump, but now we are going to talk just a little bit about Democrats. Matt Welch, I understand that in the past you have interviewed Ezra Klein, who has a new book out, Make the face you make when I say Ezra Klein.
Go on.
Right. So Ezra Klein and Derek Thompson of The Atlantic have a new book out titled Abundance. And it's basically an argument that Democrats blew it, especially on housing. They made everything too difficult to build. And we need to live in a world of abundance, a world in which more things exist, in which more things are not just computer, but actually built in the world. Do you see this as a force for good in the Democratic Party? How do you understand this movement?
I just want to express a lament that when I stopped hosting the Reason Roundtable, we removed the electrode buzzer that went to Peter Suderman's nether regions whenever he says abundance agenda. Like, zzz, you can't say that.
It's because he started liking it too much.
He started liking it too much. Yeah, totally true. Fact check true.
The secret is that I'm actually the Doge programmer Big Balls.
Did we figure out how to make everything computer so that we can rewind that last like minute of our lives? I'm as always heartened that Ezra Klein, 16 years too late, is waking up to the fact that Democratic big government bills don't deliver on the promises that they had, including promises like if you opposed it, you were objectively pro-death, which is what he argued about if you didn't want to pass Obamacare back in the day.
We passed it and mortality got worse.
Yes, which Peter has written about very well. So I'm glad that they have a book and that part of that book is reminding Democrats, even challenging them, including with Gavin Newsom, who was strangely still the governor of California, saying like, hey, you spend a lot of money. How come you didn't do anything with it? And everything sucks. That's great. I'm happy for that to be a thing that people are talking about in this little kind of liquid miasma after an election in which people pretend that they're going to pay attention to more people. And Gavin Newsom is going to talk to Steve Bannon on his podcast. And now we're open to new ideas. It'll last, like, just set your watch, like Christopher Hitchens and theocratic conservatives. Just set your watch. There you did, like, 3 months later, something's going to happen and we'll see something else. But as part of that, Democrats need any demonstration project that their governance is at all successful and not annoying. And I'm open to hearing anyone describing if they have experienced that themselves. It'd be great. We have so federalized nationalized our national discussion that we think only in terms, and Reason does this, and I do this too. There's not a big difference between the parties, et cetera, et cetera. This can be largely true on some ways. On the state and local level, it's much less true. And a lot of the people, I think, who became sort of Trump curious, certainly where I live in New York, I mean, look at those maps compared to what they were before. There's a lot of people who are just sick of Democratic misgovernance. Really, really, really sick of it. And also the piety and the annoyingness and telling you what you can and can't say. And all of it is irritating. So if this book, this terrible phrase, if all of it leads to some people actually thinking, maybe I will do something different, cool. I'm open to it. I am going to take the under pretty aggressively on that. There's no reason to suspect. You know, the abundance agenda is a thing that people say in Washington, D.C. Great. A lot of phrases. Rod Dreher used to say crunchy cons. Awesome. A lot of labels in Washington, D.C. There's not a lot of results in the world of Democrats governing as if those words mean anything to them.
Yeah, Matt, if I can just to kind of follow up on that, in New York City where we live over the weekend, you know, we got warnings that we now have to do mandatory composting. So you have in New York City where
those
garbage,
are the new crunchy cons?
Garbage is piling up everywhere and the abundance agenda hasn't quite reached, you know, Manhattan.
It's about the size of the rat population. If we can make them a little bit more abundant.
They need a leg up, right? The rats. And so, I mean, just to follow up on that, I do think the, you know, we're in that moment where the Democrats are licking their wounds and they may start talking in more interesting ways. Good for it. But look at a place, we're talking in Austin, we're talking in Texas. This is an abundance agenda state where, you know, people are freer to build whatever they want. And that's a good thing. And hopefully that will wash back out of Texas to other parts of the country, including Democratic states, Republican states, more regulated places.
Catherine, the abundance agenda sometimes sounds kind of libertarian. It sounds like the way that Democrats are lip-syncing us on tariffs, they are also lip-syncing libertarians on regulation, at least when it comes to housing policy and construction. Does that fill your non-existent heart with joy?
I, like Matt, assume that the parts of this that I like will never see the light of day. Like, I'm like, oh, that sounds pretty good. So RIP, you know, but I do, I think we might get a little bit of zoning reform from the whole abundance agenda. Like that's, if I had to bet, and I guess we're betting on this, I would say, perhaps the tide has turned at least a little, even in blue places, on the idea that sometimes it's okay to just build stuff. And that would be great. I accept.
Okay. That does sound great. So I want to, before we close out, I want to talk about briefly about someone who did build something. Manny Klausner, who was one of the founders of Reason, was such an influence on Reason Magazine, on the foundation, on so many of our lives. And I just want to go down the line here, start with Matt, and hear your memories of Manny. What did he mean to you? What did he mean to Reason? How did he shape our world?
Try not to get verklempt. It's my voice. I have laryngitis. When I came to Reason, some of you have been with me for a while here. I was a little bit weird, maybe not in the traditional role. A lot of people could have treated me with more suspicion and not generosity in those early days. And I am grateful for those of you in the room who were part of being nice to me despite your better judgment. And Manny was definitely a lead of that. My anecdote will be very similar to experiences that no doubt Catherine and Nick have had, which is that so we have you know, Reason Weekend, and then there's the annual meeting. And so the way that the inside baseball here, the way that it goes is that, like, there's the first night is the opening night dinner, right? And then the next day is the board meeting, and you steel yourself for it, and then you survive, and it's all great because we have a wonderful board, and everything's very collegial, but still you're a little bit nervous. There's people you work for there. Pleasure. And it was all about when you're going to have to talk with Manny in this process. And for me, and I don't know what it was like for you guys, but it was the opening, the pre-night board dinner, right? You would like try to like withstand the Manny thing. And he was great. And it's not because he was uncollegial. No, he was incredibly, he's like, hey, Matt, the book is looking really great. And would talk about like what he likes about it. It would lead with the praise. And then just sort of say, you know, I was thinking that maybe you could do this with the design and things. And the part of it in my tenure was that he was absolutely right. I became editor in 2008. We had the financial crisis right afterwards. So we had to tighten our belts a little bit and sort of decide, what are we going to spend money on? And I decided along with David that we wouldn't spend money on, like, let's do a big redesign right now, because we were like just trying to withstand all of this. So Manny was absolutely correct to point out that the magazine needed to be redesigned. And I was like just sort of steeling myself for withstanding his criticism, but it was always very, very gently done. But it was also like, you know, the kid in Animal House with the people on his shoulders, you know, devil and angel. And Manny was this little angel saying, magazine needs to look better. And it was really, really great towards the end of my tenure when I was shoving everything in Catherine's lap, when we finally like had a little bit of wiggle room to hire Joanna Andreessen, fantastic designer, and they could redesign the magazine and make it beautiful again. And a lot of that was really like just the gentle, loving kind of persistence of detail with Manny talking. So I have so many fondnesses about him, and you all do too. The restaurants you've been to, like weird speakeasies in Chicago, but it was always just that little trepidation and that little reminder of you could still make this thing better. And he cared that much always about doing that. So that's what I remember.
Catherine?
Mine is actually in the same vein, but in the area that I care about more than Matt does, which is copy editing. So Manny was so many things to reason, but I think one thing that a lot of people don't appreciate is that he was a volunteer copy editor for 5 decades, I think. He would send me notes, and you know, I think many of us were on his email list, but then when he wanted to send you something just for you, he recognized that maybe you weren't immediately opening every email from Manny, because there were a few. And so he would put in all caps, personal, or this was the big one, urgent. Ooh. And so you've got an all caps Manny email, you click on that bad boy. And a lot of the time it would be like, I have noticed a typo on the site. Please correct. And I was like, thanks, Manny. We'll fix it. Real sorry. And I just think that that, like, he was reading deeply and he just wanted everything to be as good as it could be. And he wasn't a jerk about it. Just like Matt said, he was just like coming from a place of love. And he was like, it's the wrong there. And in recent years, these emails dwindled, and I've never been sure. And I don't want to know whether it's because the copy editing just finally got really good, or whether Manny got really tired. But either way, I've always been grateful for the kind of love and attention to detail that he brought to Reason at every level, including the commas.
I'm going to repeat a story that a lot of people have heard, and it's great, and it's very Manny, and he loved to tell it, which is in the November 1973 special issue that Reason did early on about Ayn Rand and her legacy. And Ayn Rand, who's very litigious, contacted Reason, or her lawyers did, and said, you can't write about me without my permission. You have to pulp all the issues and issue an apology. And he wrote back to them, a lawyer by training, saying, we very much look forward to the case of Rand v. Reason. And he loved Ayn Rand. I mean, he was not antagonistic towards her and everything, but he was a man of principle and of humor and of understatement. So he just brought so much. And as on a personal level, he was incredibly generous and supportive throughout, you know, good times and bad.
Yeah, I don't think I knew Manny as well as some of you, but I lived in the world that he created now every day for the last 16 years. And the world that he built, Reason, the Reason Foundation, Reason Magazine. In building it, he helped define its character. And his character was that he loved good food and great drink and theater and intellectual debate and liberty. And he was a model for us all. So we're going to do our final segment here. And this is our cultural recommendation. But because we are in Texas, this has to be Texas themed. So Matt Welch, what Texas themed culture have you been consuming? Or do you want to recommend?
So the reason why there's a Willie Nelson statue about 30 yards from here, and that we're on Willie Nelson Way and Austin city limits here, comes down to one piece of art more than any other, which is his 1975 album, Redheaded Stranger, which is an amazing piece of work that I was re-listening to today. A double platinum record at a time when country artists were not doing that. The song that you will have heard from that definitively is Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain, which he did not write. Willie Nelson was in his 40s when that came out. He had been a Nashville songwriter, you know, Hello Walls, all these songs for other people, Crazy. He had tried to have a career of his own. It didn't really work out. And he was in his 40s, was kind of in Austin. It wasn't working, and he changed record labels in around 1973, I think, to Columbia or Atlantic at first, and released a couple of really interesting records that people liked, and then renegotiated with Columbia so that he owned everything, had all rights of all refusal. So this is At the time when Motown and Stevie Wonder is declaring sort of financial independence in sports, which I've written about for Reason, a lot of athletes are starting to be a free agency to find their own voice. So Willie Nelson did that with country music at that time in Austin. And it's a really weird record, people. It's just him up on the mic. He's a fantastic guitar player and a fantastic phraseologist singing. He just has this, and he was at the peak of both of those powers, and there's almost nothing else on this. There's a little bit of piano played by, I think, his sister, some drums and a harmonica here and there. It's super intimate. It's like a, it's like the Desert Oracle podcast late at night. It's like you don't want to be that intimate with anything, frankly. And it's the record company's like, what are you even doing? This is a demo? Are you kidding with this? And they had to basically get Waylon Jennings in New York, probably to threaten to rip someone's lungs out in order to have it produced. And they released it. And again, double platinum record. And it became this mechanism by which outlaw country, this new genre, would sort of relocate to Austin. Austin City Limits started as a regular TV show, I think, in 1975. Right then, they released the also huge record, the Outlaw Country record. That's not the name of it, but like Wanted Outlaws, I guess what it is, with Waylon Jennings and Willie Nelson in 1976. Just sold a trillion records. It's incredible. So all of that happened, and this sort of relocation of this more artistically independent Austin. And what's interesting about it is that Outlaw Country is all super, like, it's rock and roll. It's Waylon Jennings, and it's a lot of guitar. It's all this. But this one record, and I really recommend that you go listen to it, is just so quiet. It's a concept album. I think it's about some guy who maybe killed his wife or something. It's sort of difficult to follow along, but it's incredibly evocative and just beautiful. And a great artist who's still with us in his 90s, at the peak of his powers. So go check it out, Redheaded Stranger.
Catherine?
So I was gonna, in keeping with my general brand and also a recommendation I've made previously on this podcast, talk about the Neal Stephenson novel Termination Shock, which does feature a Texas billionaire that tries to solve global warming by shooting sulfur into the stratosphere. And I'm not recommending that because it's really good. But I'm changing my recommendation midstream because what I actually want to recommend is country line dancing, which I did for the first time today, and which is awesome. Congratulations to Texas and everyone else involved in the creation of country line dancing. I learned the boot, scoot, and boogie today. And the thing that is fantastic is everybody has their version of this thing, right? Like, it's the electric slide. It's the cha-cha slide. It's everything that happens at an Indian wedding, if you're at the right wedding. It's the same thing. And it's just like human beings shuffling around together in a square. And it's great. And so my official Reason Roundtable recommendation this week is the boot, scoot, and boogie.
So I'm going with Mike Judge's King of the Hill, an animated TV show that ran for 13 seasons from 1997 until 2009 with some episodes in 2010 as well. And it takes place in Arlen, Texas. Hank Hill sells propane and propane accessories. I happened to be living in Texas when it started, and everybody in Texas was like, oh, Arlen is my hometown. It's a great cast of characters. Libertarians will particularly like Dale Gribble, next door neighbor who's a conspiracy truther, let's say. He's not wrong about anything. But what's great about it, and it's like South Park, it's like Peanuts, it is this massive vision, an alternative reality of what America is about to become. Texas is becoming the most populous state in the country. It's going to be the cultural center. It's going to define the identity of America for the rest of this century. And that kind of begins in the beautiful world of Arlen, Texas, and King of the Hill. It's a great cast of characters that make fun of each other and themselves and America, but it also is very serious about this is a warm, wonderful place filled with strange, wonderful people. And when you let them get on with their lives, good things happen. So, King of the Hill.
Hey, Nick.
The great state of Texas. So,
I will close us out with my recommendation, which is a movie that is about a decade old. It is called Hell or High Water. It is a great bank robbery film, a heist film set mostly in Texas and a little bit in Oklahoma. The movie was written by a guy named Taylor Sheridan. Now, if you know Taylor Sheridan's work right now, he's the guy who created Yellowstone, as well as Landman, a TV show set in Texas. All these spinoffs of Yellowstone, the spy show. He's got like a Tulsa King mafia show set in Oklahoma as well. But right now he's sort of the TV's reigning king of red American television. But before that, he wrote feature films. And in particular, he wrote Sicario and Hell or High Water and Wind River, which were his American frontier trilogy. And I think the best of them is Hell or High Water. And there's a movie about two brothers who are being chased by Texas agents because the brothers, what's that? Texas Rangers, right? Yes, Texas Rangers. And the brothers are robbing banks, and these guys are on their trail. And what you come to see is, I think, a picture of a kind of pre-Trump America, a world in which people who value hard work and who value owning your own land, they're robbing banks basically to pay the bank back to make sure that they can hold on to their home. And you see this world of people who distrust elites, this world of people who just want to make it on their own. And it is a kind of stirring and really effective picture of an America that gave us the world of Donald Trump 2.0 and Doge and all of these things that we have been talking about. And so if you want to sort of see the origin story expressed in a really great cinematic thriller, Hell or High Water is just a great film. And then all of the rest of his works, Yellowstone, Landman, really kind of plumb the same sort of cultural milieu and show us the kind of cultural forces that are at work in America right now in a way that I just don't think any other writer, any other filmmaker today is doing. So, all right, folks, that is our show. If you are listening at home and you are curious about Reason Weekend or any of our other events, you can find out more at our events pages on our websites, reason.com and reason.org. The Reason Roundtable will return next week. Thank you all so much.